You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, news editor at the IEA. Today I'll be discussing trade arrangements and customs unions post-Brexit with Shankar Singham, who's joining the IEA as the director of our new International Trade and Competition Unit. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our podcast channel, IEA Conversations. Shankar, what did you make of the Prime Minister's speech last week? Is she moving things forward, or do you think it was a lot more of the same?
Well, first of all, I think we should understand that it's a speech. In terms of what the speech was intended to do, it was to put a bit more colour on the, you know, flesh on the bones of what we actually want as a country in terms of this UK-EU trade agreement, partnership, whatever you want to call it. And I thought she did that, you know, relatively well. She certainly cleared a few areas up that people had felt there wasn't sufficient clarity on. And I think the main things that she said that were important was she continued to say that we will be outside of the customs union, and we will be outside of the single market. And the critical piece of it was, I think, her references to ensuring disciplines on anti-competitive practices and mutual recognition, that we would essentially have a free trade agreement with mutual recognition. And I think that was a very important step forward.
What do you think is going to ultimately be defined as mutual recognition? Is this another issue with, say, the word alignment being bandied about, that no one actually really knows what that means until the trade deal actually happens?
Mm. Well, first of all, as I said, it's a speech, so it's not negotiating text. And I think sometimes there's a perception that we need to have everything out there in the speech that is negotiating. You know, you don't negotiate in public. So what we need to do now, I think, as a country, is stop negotiating with ourselves and actually start negotiating with the European Union. And there are various things in this trade agreement that need to be done, that take time. And there are other things that are really difficult deal breaker type issues. And I think in terms of the deal breaker type issues, the issue of regulatory alignment, as you described, is one of those. So the way we should look at this is the goal here, the ultimate objective, is whether we can get the UK to be able to express an independent trade policy. An independent trade policy consists of what you can do to improve your unilateral regulatory system and reduce tariffs where you can, what you do bilaterally, doing trade deals with other people, and also, obviously, the bilateral trade deal with the EU. What you can do plurilaterally, for example, acceding to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This would be one of the most significantly liberalizing trade initiatives ever, and we should certainly try to accede to it. And then what do you do multilaterally in the WTO and in global standard-setting organizations? So you can operate in global standard-setting organizations to promote pro-competitive regulation. You can operate in the WTO to promote further liberalization. Not that the UK is going to be some sort of swashbuckling 16th century actor forcing other countries to bend to its will, but rather that the fact that you've got the second biggest exporter of services, one of the biggest foreign investors in the world, suddenly able to execute an independent trade policy will certainly be used by other countries to advance and unblock some of the things that have been stalled at the multilateral level. So all of that is what you want to be able to do. And to do that, you can't be in the customs union, because then you can't have a trade policy, you can't have trade deals with other countries, and you can't be in the single market. You can't be too closely regulatory aligned to the EU either, because you will have to have control of your tariff schedules and control of your regulatory system. As long as you have control of your regulatory system, and other countries don't, you know, they will understand if we have a regulatory coherence chapter in a trade deal. They'll understand if there's a pan-European regulatory college where we, you know, work together to ensure better regulation on both sides of the channel. What they won't understand and what they won't be able to deal with is if we give the European Union a veto over our regulatory choices, or if we're on a sort of hair trigger where the moment we make some change, we lose access without any kind of, you know, process. So as long as we avoid those two things, we can have lots of regulatory conversations with the EU. All of that will be fine. But we must preserve our ability to control our own regulatory system.
Are you pragmatic about the way that this will play during the negotiations with the EU, and also potentially how things could change over time? So if we, say, did have these controls over our own regulatory systems, the UK could decide, even after any transitional period to remain aligned more or less, with the EU, but as things change 10, 20, 50 years down the line, can make the choice to diverge.
We can essentially make that decision, and that is a decision for the British people, and that's a decision for the Parliament of the day. And what the Parliament of the day or the British people need to think about is this could happen in a number of ways. We might be negotiating a trade deal with the US, for example. The US may say, in order to get the benefits of the deal, in order to get the better services liberalisation, better defence trade agreement, whatever, in order to get that, we're going to have to change some domestic regulatory things. They may ask for certain things to be changed. And we'll have to decide at that time, are we prepared to do that? Do we want to do that? And that's going to depend on where the gains are. And it's going to depend on what our own view of that regulatory system is. We may also unilaterally decide to change things. We may unilaterally decide that certain financial services regulations, like, you know, MiFID II and others, are not good for the City of London, are not good for financial services. And we may decide that we're going to change them. We're going to have a different kind of approach. And we'll have, when we do that, we'll have a process with the European Union. But again, in that process where we're trying to keep mutual recognition, we can't cede control over our regulatory choices. And it's very important. One of the things the Prime Minister did say in her speech is, what are you aligning to? As long as our regulatory objectives are the same, then differences in how you get there, differences in how you achieve those goals and those objectives shouldn't defeat recognition, which is, that is the WTO position. That is the technical barriers to trade agreement, the sanitary and phytosanitary, the agreement that deals with matters related to human, animal and plant health. Those agreements set out a framework for how mutual recognition should work, and we can build on those in other areas. And there's an overall direction of travel of the WTO in dealing with mutual recognition and regulatory issues. And what we need to be doing with the EU is building on the work that has already taken place. And there's no reason we can't come up with a groundbreaking new regulatory mechanism, because we are going to be aligned completely on day one. We are going to be in the unique situation no two countries have ever been in and never will be again. Whereas we'll be starting to do a trade deal with absolutely identical regulatory systems.
So the only thing the UK can really do is diverge, and it will be very knowledgeable and clear about what it's diverging on.
Yeah.
Control over one's regulatory choices is a red line for you in this next phase of the negotiations that are particularly related to trade. What else would be a red line?
The whole area of customs, I think it's very, very important that we also have control of our tariff schedules. What we're doing right now in the WTO is we're going through a process of determining what our schedules actually are. And so there will be a set of schedules that we'll place before the WTO before we leave in March of 2019. And those schedules, the tariff will be the common external tariff of the European Union. That will be our starting point. But it is incredibly important that we're able to, in a trade deal where we're going to lower those tariffs, or maybe unilaterally, maybe we'll simply decide, you know, one example might be products in agriculture that we don't produce and things that are not competitive with things that we do produce. We might want to lower those tariffs right away, because if we do that, we're making food cheaper for people in the UK. And of course, the poorest people. Yeah, and the poorest people are the ones who are most affected by this. Food, clothing, textiles, shoes, these sorts of things, on which we can reduce those tariffs, are the lion's share of their weekly spending. That's not the case for very rich people. So for poor people, this could be a very big win very quickly. So we certainly want to be able to do that. We want to make, you hear a lot about the automotive industry. We want to make the automotive industry and other manufacturing more competitive. One way of doing that is to lower, as the Canadians have done, the intermediate goods tariff to zero. No reason why we can't do that. It's right now, auto parts is at 4.5%. Well, we don't need to do that. We can lower that to zero, and we can make our domestic manufacturing that much more competitive. So these are the kinds of things that we may want to do in the tariff area and in the customs area. Now, you also want to make sure that you minimize as much as possible the costs of customs clearance and, you know, irritant customs systems, because we're moving from free circulation to something that is not free circulation. But it's very important that we understand what those increased costs are and what's the price that we pay for keeping them zero. So you don't need to be in a customs union or a partial customs union or any kind of customs union in order to have good customs clearance mechanisms. The US-Canada border is probably the best border for customs clearance in the world. And there is, and it's part of a free trade agreement, not a customs union. And there's a lot of technology on the border. There's a lot of use of trusted trader programs. There's a lot of mechanisms like self-assessment and other mechanisms to speed up the process of goods that are going across that border. Similarly, the Australia-New Zealand border, the Ansurta sort of water border, is also a very effective and well-run border. And there will be a customs chapter in the free trade agreement. Mm-hmm. So when the Prime Minister talks about a special customs arrangement, there will be in a chapter in the trade agreement a special customs arrangement. Special because we're neighbouring, and under the WTO, neighbouring countries can have special customs relationships. And so we will seek to put as much into that to speed up the flow of goods as much as we can, to make clearance as easy as we can, to utilise ourselves things like self-assessment, trusted trader programmes, AEO programmes, all of these things to ensure that we can make the cost of customs clearance. It's a spectrum. You know, on the one side, it's zero in free circulation. At the other end of the extreme, if you do none of these things, then you might have a significant cost. We want to raise the cost just as little as we possibly can. There will be a cost, but it will be quite small, in my view, if we do these things.
You mentioned March 2019 as the date that the UK is exiting the European Union. That is now a year away. How optimistic are you that the UK can come up with this bespoke kind of trade deal in that period of time, and how good is it going to be?
Right, so we don't need to come up with the trade deal in that time, because what we're asking for from the European Union, and what frankly they are also interested in having, is this implementation period, which will probably run until at least December of 2020.
So you think it's unlikely that March 2019 will hit that date and there will be a finalised?
No, what there will be is a withdrawal agreement which will include a framework for the future trade relationship. And the framework will essentially say, I would imagine, that it's going to be a free trade agreement, that there are going to be a goods chapter. It's going to say something about special customs arrangement. It's going to say something about services liberalisation. And it will talk about mutual recognition as a mechanism. And it may have some regulatory ideas, actually, in terms of what those regulatory recognition mechanisms might look like. So it'll be a broad framework agreement. And then, you know, you build from your framework agreement to a trade deal. The average length of time it takes to do trade deals is about 28 months. And that includes all the EU deals that take a very long time.
Right.
But remember,
the EU,
those deals are with countries that aren't completely in alignment at the beginning of the trade negotiation, don't have zero tariffs, don't have the situation that we're in. The Australia-US deal was about 15 months. The NAFTA was 14 months. I mean, the trade deal does not need to take very long. It depends on political will and defensive baggage. Now, we have a huge advantage, which is that we start with no tariffs and we start with regulatory alignment. And so I think it's perfectly possible, with people of goodwill, to come up between now in 2018 and December 2020 with an agreement that works. And once you've got an agreement that works, you can continue to evolve it. They aren't agreed and then nothing happens. They are constantly evolving, and you know, new protocols are constantly added, and I'm sure that's what will happen in this case.
And while the UK and the EU are discussing this potential framework, as you say, to guide the trade negotiations once the UK has officially left, a lot of other things are happening politically and also policy related around the world. And it's very notable that one of the best benefits of Brexit is the opportunity to pursue your own trade deals. And of course, one of the primary countries that the UK is hoping to get a pretty fast trade deal with has just had the president start declaring trade wars on his own allies. So have people been too optimistic about the UK's position in negotiating these trade deals post-Brexit?
You got to be quite nuanced about the Trump. He's not particularly a master of nuance himself, but
no,
I think we have to be quite nuanced about the position of the US here, because a lot of these things have been in train for quite some time. So the US concern right now is that in international trade, while border measures have been dealt with relatively well, There are a lot of market distortions in countries around the world, notably China, and notably China for steel. So we have not been very effective globally, and the US certainly has not been very effective, at disciplining those distortions, at stopping the Chinese government from artificially reducing the cost of its steel producers. Nothing wrong with being a cheap steel producer if you do it on your own merits, if you do it through your own efficiency. But if it's the government that's actually giving you free land and free water and free energy and so forth, and artificially lowering your costs so you're a better competitor, that is a problem. And this is, actually, frankly, this is one of the reasons that Trump won the election in the first place. Is there is this sense that that trade is somehow unfair. And in some cases it is. Now, there's two ways you can handle this. You can deal with the distortions. You can have an agreement that deals with distortions. You can use the TPP, for example, to really push the Chinese to lower their levels of distortion. And you can come up with a trade remedy mechanism yourself that discriminates between an efficient China steel producer and one that is actually supported in this way. That's one thing you could do. The other thing you could do is slap a huge tariff on everything. And you know, yes, you'll get the distorting product out, but you'll also hit a lot of other people on the way, which is, of course, what has happened with this Section 232 action that the Trump administration has announced, you know, these tariffs on steel and aluminium. But for these reasons, it's even more important, I think, for the US to do a trade deal with the UK. It's very important for the president to have some part of his trade agenda that isn't pulling out of agreements or protectionism. And one of the things that he can do with the UK is say, look, we are both at a similar sort of level. It's not a race to the bottom. There aren't going to be huge numbers of US jobs offshored to the UK.
There's not a huge trade deficit either, which the president always complains about.
That's right. So there's not, you know, we sort of oddly maintain surpluses with each other. So yeah. So that's sort of fine. And we can, but we have the same problem. We have the same problem with distortions in other countries, particularly China Steel, in fact, because we've had Port Talbot and Redcar closing down. They've had mills in Ohio and Pennsylvania and so forth closing down. So there is actually an alignment here where we can say, look, why don't we agree a set of disciplines? We can do this ourselves, that disciplines distortions in third countries. This is one of the things that the TTIP was originally supposed to do. The EU-US Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership was supposed to be a template for third countries. It failed because the EU and the US couldn't agree on regulatory issues, but we are going to be able to agree with the US much more easily on these issues. And so it's a great advantage to the US, in fact, to have a deal with somebody. If you're going to do bilateral deals, we're one of the most obvious candidates. And that's one of the reasons, you know, Donald Trump has said, you know, you're at the front of the list, not at the back of the list.
Yes, I agree. He did mean that. To wrap up and to bring things back over to politics on this side of the pond, does it worry you that both Brexiteers and Remainers were pretty happy with Theresa May's speech last week? Are we still approaching some kind of blow up, at least politically, as these trade negotiations continue?
Well, you know, in a trade negotiation, there's always moments when, you know, there's an explosion and things look like, you know, everything is lost and you know, the plaster's coming off the ceiling and so on. And we can expect a lot of that. I mean, that is simply going to be the way it will be for the next couple of years or three
years.
Chaos
is the new stable.
And what I think people need to do is recognize that there is an overall trajectory that gets us to a trade deal. There'll be a lot of bumps in the road, and there'll be a lot of moments while you wake up and think it's all a disaster and everything's fallen apart. One of the things she had to do, I think, with the speech was create a bit more cohesion amongst her own party, which I think she's successfully done. But at the end of the day, what matters now is putting negotiating text on the table for the Europeans to react to. We need to do that sort of as a matter of urgency. And we can expect that when we do that, we'll get a negative response. But this is a negotiation. We have a tendency, I think, sometimes to allow our own perceptions of whether things are negotiable with the EU to colour what we actually put forward. The EU, it does not operate like that. You know, if they did, they wouldn't have, you know, put 100 billion euro on the table as their first offer. So we need to start putting our own ideas on the table and getting that process moving. I think her speech was a good step in terms of political cohesion here. But there is a point at which the negotiation moves from speeches to actual negotiating text. And that's basically, I think, the point that we're at now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more blogs, podcasts, films and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.